It also relates to an earlier paper, which I would think is of equal importance, maybe. That was the Helms paper on mathematical simplification of boundary value problems. That technique is, as far as I know, the first one which reduces all partial differential equations to ordinary ones. If it can be done, it tells you. So this is a great clean-cut thing, and why this was always overlooked by mathematicians, I have no knowledge. Birkhoff at Harvard did something related to this, but nobody ever reduced this to a practical...
I suppose it's because the mathematicians didn't have to worry about the practical implications.
They weren't interested in doing this. But it always bothered me, I guess, all my career. I'm not very good when people say it's obvious that, or if you... It really bugged me that people would say, if you let z equal y squared over x is reduced to an ordinary differential equation. And I kept asking myself, why? And I finally asked it with David Helms in the right way. And we sat down and we went through a very exciting week in which every day we both had a new idea, in which we said, well, if we leave the decision to the last minute, we will do this in a very general way, and we leave the decision, we ought to just be able to see what to do. And sure enough, that pops out. And so
the paper to which you are referring is entitled Simplification of the Mathematical Description of Boundary and Initial Value Problems, and it was written in 1964 with J.D. Helms.
We have done a little more work since then, but essentially that was done so completely then that it's hard to improve on it. There's a later article in the Australian journal and some others that update this a little bit, but basically it's all in that paper. And that's pretty well, I think, recognized. Everybody uses that technique. I teach this now to all the sophomores. They may be the only sophomores in the world to know how to do this, but my argument is it's easy, and therefore I gave them a test on the juniors today. That's what they took a test on. And they can produce these things that everybody else thinks are black magic.
I just wish to make one comment from what I see. You seem to have this tremendous ability to synthesize, to reach out and integrate. You have brought mathematics and chemical engineering close together. You've worked on problems that you can integrate into a computer-type sorts of problems. You've extended your hand to people across the oceans as you were working at Michigan at the AICHE. I see that as a motif of your work, of your education, and I just wish to mention that.
Now, I suspect that it also may be a weakness. I realize that one of my problems is that I don't put any bound on what I do. Don Katz used to tell me that I was in great danger in my career because I didn't pick some nice single problem and become the world expert on it and work on it. And he said every time I turned around, I was working on a new problem. I don't think they went all that far, but I think that I have looked at a broader range, even here, in chemical engineering than most of my colleagues do. And so I may be an amateur in all these things, but it's easier, therefore, to see the structure between chemical reaction engineering and heat transfer or mass transfer or mathematical modeling or correlation.
But they may all be different problems, but you use the same powerful approach in looking at all the different problems.
And you see marvelous things that somebody over here has the solution for something over here if you can only identify that they're the same things. And this may be more... Engineering tends to be very compartmentalized, and even chemical engineering. And it's hard to talk to other people, and it's hard to know they have the same problem because they write things down differently. I've been working the last few years. I have piled up at home parts of 20 books, almost all done. The problem, however, is that this it's too much, and I'm having a great struggle to try to get this kind of wound up, because the material keeps building up in each of these, and I can't really stop any place. But they will be different. I don't know that the one on food mechanics will come out next year. And that's actually going to be what I did have divided into four different ones. But I think that's the limitation of what I do. I try to read over too wide a scope, and I can't do it. Therefore, things certainly get away from me that I ought to be on top of.
Well, anybody who's working on 20 books has certainly got a sense for it.
Well, I don't know how you're working on 20 books. You publish no less than 17 technical articles or portions of books in 1983. You have published, this is unbelievable, 12 articles in 1984. How do you turn all this out?
Well, I probably will slacken off on some articles in this next year, simply because I've been making a great burst of effort on the book, and it does take, you can't do all things.
Sure.
And but I have decided that I'm at a stage in my career where if the ideas I have in synthesizing are, if we're going to reach other people, I ought to stop and put them together and put them out. And this is only can be in a book. It's not a technical type of article. So I don't intend to stop doing research, but I probably may be less ambitious in getting it into print instantly and try to clean up all these books. Mm-hmm. See, the book on correlation, that technique itself, I have a complete draft on, but you know, I'm dissatisfied, and it's going to take, and the only time I have really to write on the book is almost in the summer. Mm-hmm. You cannot be uninterrupted very often to do this otherwise.
I wonder if we could ask you to, at this point, might be best to move, just ask you to reflect on the differences in chemical engineering and chemical engineering science between the late 1930s, when you first encountered chemistry at Michigan, and let's say the late 50s, when you were then a tenured member of the faculty at Michigan, and now. And how has chemical engineering changed over the past 45 years?
But it's changed incredibly from almost an entirely empirical field with a very little bit of algebraic structure to one which has become very, very scientifically oriented with a great deal of theory, which maybe theory is dominant, maybe even overly so, compared to experimentation. And this was a gradual process that perhaps began to accelerate in the 50s. I think computers had more impact on this than computers, and the fact that all the graduate students after the war came back and took advanced mathematics, what really transformed the field. And as you mentioned, the books like Marshall and Pickford and Sherwood and Reed had to be there for to do. One of my actually distant relative, Rural Churchill, wrote three books: Modern Operational Mathematics and Boundary Value Problems, and the third one is Theory of Complex Variable. Those came out right that time. Somehow, for the first time, they were readable books for engineers to study those subjects. And I think those kind of things coalesced. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of theory, you mentioned in an article that you would attempt, and I'm quoting you, to put theory in its proper place in engineering as a guide to correlation and occasionally as a source of a priori of predictions. How has it been going? How has the battle
gone? Well, I think I said in there also that interface continually moved in the direction of theory. If you look through, you will find that statement. And I think it's still moving. The source of all new things, though, is observational. I mean, all the new things, somebody observes something, or even if they speculate theoretically, it doesn't mean anything until they go out and confirm this. And so people who I was critical for a while, although I don't think I am so much more, of Neil Amundsen and Gus Aris and the people in Minnesota, they never did any experimental work, and they, in a sense, asked other people to test what they were doing. And my observation is nobody ever tests anybody else's theory. You only test your own. And so for a while, I thought they were doing things, and to some extent, this is true, in so abstract that no one else would ever know whether they were right or not. But I think other people have done that. They were doing correct theoretical work, and in the long run, it was better than I thought.
Has this tendency toward theory then in the past 30 years or so had, I mean, the answer is probably obvious, but what effect has it had on chemical engineering design and actual application in the industry? Has there been a direct effect, or is
it? Well, the design element fell right into the basement for a while, but it was revived by computer-aided design. And so it went from, it really was in sad shape for a while, but strangely, I think the universities are far ahead of industry in this now. It is Warren Cedar and Art Westerberg at Carnegie Mellon and these people who are the leaders in this field now, not anybody in industry.
So they're now designing elements of new large-scale processes from first principles?
Well, at least they're synthesizing. These people are only synthesizing. They are taking equations of various kinds and putting them together. But no one could do that before there were large-scale computers. And that's a big impact. There's an element of the Ford Foundation work at the University of Michigan that Don Katz had that they discovered early when they decided that the study was to find out whether computers should be used in undergraduate education in engineering. Strangely enough, that was a moot point at the time. And they discovered rather soon that if a faculty member learned how to use a computer, he immediately became favorable. If he didn't, he always was opposed and had no role. And so it became quite clear to them early that the only problem to get this a fair evaluation and therefore used when it should be or not was to make positive that the faculty did not have any insecurity about this and knew how to use it. And I think that's true of many areas. We suffer from people who are good experimentalists. There's a lack of these. In the 60s and things, no one did any experimental work, or very few did. These were the people who went out to teach. So the universities, the people now 10 years who are the young leaders in chemical engineering in the country, are most of them pure theorists. And they, of course, will not teach experimental work or do it. There is some revival in some areas, like the bioengineering area. People know they have to do experimental work, but there are whole other areas where no one ever does experiments.
So, do you think that the impact of that is going to be felt in the future, or I mean, is that legacy going to decline? And people?
Well, I think that legacy will decline. I think experimental work will increase again, but I think it's at a fairly low point now, and I think it's climbing. It's not as bad at Penn as some places. I guess Warren Cedar does no experimental work. I don't know whether Lyle Unger will. Almost everybody else on the faculty is basically an experimentalist, so that's unusual. Well, Alan Myers is not basically an experimentalist, nor Edward Gland is a zero experimentalist. So we have maybe a third, but many universities may have a majority of non-experimentalists.
Now, how would we spoke earlier about the relative reputations of Michigan, MIT, Minnesota, Delaware in the 50s and early 60s. How would you, I mean, how does that look now in the 80s?
It's changed radically in the past 10 years. One of the problems is that the recognition of the status of people lags 5 to 10 years. You can go into an absolute funk and nobody will notice for 5 or 10 years. I think MIT did not belong in the top 10 universities in the United States 5 years ago.
In
chemical engineering. I think they thought they were first, but I don't think they were even among the top 10. And if they rated fifth or sixth in these polls, it was only by inertia. Michigan was once first or second, and I'm sure it fell out of the top 10 during this same period. And Minnesota and Illinois came up, and Princeton and Delaware, Northwestern, Houston, and Penn. And I suppose the most remarkable rise of all of these is Penn. Penn probably, from 1960 to the present, made the biggest upward step of any school in the United States. It went from nowhere. If you look, you would hardly find Penn rated in the 50s and 60s. It was a small faculty and had no impact. And now, we might think we're one of the top two or three. I think we are. I don't think in a poll would quite put us that high because of the inertia effect, but we might be in the top five even in a poll now. We were tied for 10th or 11th in the last one about 6 or 7 years ago, and that was not really reflective.
Do you think it's possible to characterize the departments that have come to prominence in the last 10 or 20 years in a particular way, the way that we talked about the impact of applied mathematics on Minnesota and Michigan and the other departments in the 50s?
But we have to somehow get the eye of other people, and in particular of the good graduate students, because basically that's the weather vane that tells you where the good place is, and you could look at also publications and accounts of this kind. Art Humphrey probably was the major factor in Penn's rise. He was prominent as a bioengineer when no one else was, and for a long time, majority of students who came here because of Art Humphrey, although they didn't end up working for him. But now, we're in a unique position of almost any department of having a completely active faculty. All of our faculty do the same thing. We all do research, we all teach undergraduates, we all do graduate. We have no dead wood of any kind.
That's
and
right.
Part of it's luck and part of it is a lot of hard thought. Most departments eventually decay because they get some people who look very good at 40 and for personal reasons or who knows what quit. And they never quit so much that you can get rid of them. And I would judge Michigan has 25 or 30% of that type now. And that's a big anchor around their neck. And it takes a while to get rid of them. Even though you get good young people, their impact isn't felt right away. And people have had bad luck. Delaware has had more, and Princeton have both had terrible luck. And they've surmounted this. But you know, Dick Wilhelm, who was one of the top people in the country, died at 55 or something, and then Leon Lapidus about the same age, and they were their two stars. And Delaware had also Gerster and Farron and Kurt Pickford got mad and left. And Delaware has realized that they must immediately strike back and get somebody prominent nationally back in, and they've always done this. Princeton has been less good at this, and therefore they've slumped the last few years, but they'll come back because they have a motivation to.
You've elucidated for us relations between various universities, various academic centers, how they have changed over the period of time. Would you also please explain to us the relationship between academic and industrial chemical engineers when you began to do your chemical engineering, and has this relationship changed since then, and if so, how has it changed?
I think the relationship has always been either through the AICAG or through consulting, not through research. And this ebbs and flows with time. It probably is not as prominent as it was in the 50s. I think there was a greater relationship, maybe because there were just less people and less schools, and maybe because I was at the center of one of those I felt all the people came. We had industrial fellowships then in Michigan, perhaps from 30 companies. Mm. Nobody has that many now. And that one school in Penn, we'd be lucky if we had 10. Michigan probably doesn't have 5 now. It's just that companies could focus then, I think, also on a few schools. And now there are 100 graduate programs and things. This tends to be a little more diffuse. And as Warren Cedar has been worrying about, the academic influence in the AICHE has, for unknown reasons, just gone way down. There are almost no members of council, and I think that this is serious, because not that the academic people are special, but it is the frontier where they sort of decide on mutual goals and exchange information. The leaders in the field are acquainted with the leaders in industry and academia. With each other, something desirable happens.
You alluded a moment ago to another long-term trend that might be I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about. Saying that now, of course, there are 100 graduate programs, when in the 50s there weren't quite as many graduate programs in Kennedy. And you spoke briefly last week about the social relationships among leading chemical engineers. I mean, how has that changed? Do chemical engineers as a community,
I don't think that has changed. And it's a very unique thing to maybe chemical engineering. I don't know any other field. We all know each other. Mm-hmm. We sort of know each other socially, and we move around and visit. We have here 30 people come from other universities every year to give lectures. Every week we have somebody, and we all do this. So there's great exchange. The reason we always could tell the ECPD what was going on is I know what's going on at Berkeley. If they have troubles, somehow the grapevine in 2 days tells me. So that, and I think this is generally the case. We most of us know each other, even on a first name basis. And, the AICHE meeting, the annual one, is really a great gathering of all the faculty, and they sit around and talk and trade graduate students and hire people and do this. That's a very lively and unique thing. I do not think it exists, maybe in metallurgy, but I don't think in electrical engineering. In fact, I know it doesn't. They're too big. In chemistry, maybe all of the physical chemists know each other, or at least the thermodynamic ones, and maybe the organic synthesis ones all know each other, but they don't know the other chemists. It's just too many.
Do you think it's just a scale factor?
Well, scale factor helps. But it has not changed much, while the faculties may have doubled. We all read the same journals, and despite the fact that our work is spread out and I don't read anything that some of my colleagues ever write, somehow I still know they exist. And I hope this is maintained. I think it has a big impact. We all teach the same thing, too. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned journals a minute ago. Are there central journals now that have changed since the late 30s and 40s? I mean, does chemical engineering depend on a few central journals, and has that changed over the past
years? That's been a real crisis. With the onset of photocopying, the journals all crashed. So Industrial Engineering Chemistry, which had 14,000 subscribers, vanished almost, and now has the little fundamentals group. AICHE journal subscriptions have crashed, and so they publish less and less pages, not more. They suddenly decided to reverse this. This meant that the commercial publishers filled the vacuum, and so they have taken over a large role in publication. Unfortunately, of course, the reviewing processes and the costs are a different matter. They may or may not review as carefully, and they sell these journals not for $20 a year, but for $200, so only libraries take them. Mm-hmm. And that element has deteriorated. It's just an economic thing that's very unfortunate. The argument that has been given to reinstate the AICHE journal in double issues is if we don't do that, there will be no central place where people read about other people's work and so forth.
I think we're slowly turning toward your teaching, and on as we turn that way, tell us a bit about textbooks, how they have changed over the course of the years. How effective are they now?
Well, textbooks have changed, but they generally lag behind the field, and there's no profitability in writing a textbook unless you write a Bird, Stuart, and Lightfoot, and maybe Smith's book and Smith and Van Ness. Only a few textbooks ever pay the authors the time, and therefore they don't ever get polished, and there's a shortage, and this has been a remaining shortage of good textbooks. I never use a textbook. I always teach from notes. I was reading an MIT book that traditionally that's what they always did, and I guess it's a dissatisfaction. You think you're doing newer things than are in any of the textbooks. Now, that's only characteristic of the research universities.
Yeah.
Villanova would not teach a course unless there was a textbook that was a one-to-one correspondence and a solution manual worked out. Because if you teach 12 hours a week, you don't have any time to make up new problems or anything of this kind or to put in new work. So there's a two-tier operation here, and I may overemphasize the one tier, but Minnesota and Wisconsin and Berkeley and MIT and Penn are not really worried about they may use a textbook or not.
You received the Warren Award in 1976. Is given for the excellence of your teaching. Would you care to speak a bit about your philosophy and style of teaching?
Well, my philosophy and style of teaching are, at least the style is somewhat unique. I know because of the reactive suits. I'm not terribly well organized, but on the other hand, I don't teach from notes or anything. I just talk with the students. And therefore, I go through the same process of confronting a problem and so forth with them. So it's an interactive thing. And eventually, they come to grips with this. And this kind of works, because we're just here talking like this about, and therefore I often don't know what I'm going to do when I go into the classroom, but I know the subject, and I have no real thing. And sometimes strange things happen. I find students either like this or they don't. And some hate this. They want somebody who comes in and writes neatly, and everything is precise, and if I learn that, I will pass the test, and so forth. And pretty soon they know, with me, they're going to do some creative thing in the test, and it's hard for me to say what I'm going to test them on anyway. And so they have to put up with a certain amount of this. But I think this is a thing. And this is what I learned, perhaps, from Brown and White, and because they talk the same way. So
I was going to ask that, because the last session we had, you were talking about Brown in particular, is using the Socratic method. It sounded like a law school class almost.
Well, with Brown, it was. I don't use quite the Socratic method as much, but I tend just to be there sort of doing this. Now, this is contrasted with Joe Martin at Michigan, whom I admired and always speak to, who is terribly precise. Mm-hmm. And no comma was ever out, and everything. Therefore, if you just listened, he laid out the field for you in perfect order. And Warren Cedar does the same thing. I mean, I just like to see the blackboard after he gets done and see mine, which tends to look like this. I wish I were a little more organized, but I guess the other works too. The class, undergraduate class I teach, is an elective, so none of the students have to take it, and they all take it. So it's.
Another thing thought occurs to me. Joe asked about textbooks. Has the trend toward a more theoretical cast of chemical engineering percolated down into the entry level textbooks or the beginning texts?
I think so, although I'm not sure to what extent they are widely used. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of super theoretical textbooks out. There are textbooks in fluid mechanics that I can't read because they're too mathematical, Whitaker's book and some of the others are this way. If people use those, they use them either they're more mathematical than I am, or they do this for prestige-wise, and the students may not understand. There are good textbooks. When I taught stoichiometry, I used Rousseau and Felder's book last semester. I thought it was an excellent book. And I felt very comfortable instantly picking this up, and I just told the students, we'll read this and I'll embellish this. But to me, it was accessible, and I think the students...
Has your style of teaching changed since you've come to Penn, or are you doing the same sorts of things you did there?
I think I do pretty much the same. I mean, I've changed, I'm sure, with the years, but my overall style has probably never changed.
And how about getting out of the classroom? How about your interaction with your PhD advisees? Do you deal with them in the same manner in which you dealt with them in Michigan?
Yes. I think they sort of, after they've been here a year, become part of my family and in a loose way. And they are my friends in the world. When I went to Houston, I had dinner with three of them the two nights I was there. And this is sort of instant pickup. We keep in touch this way. They sometimes just call right now just to say hello. And I think we have that kind of feeling. I never intimidated any of these people, at least after they got to know me.
You mentioned when you did your dissertation that Breyer was your advisor and that he more or less let you, he supported you, but you more or less worked on it on your own. How do you relate to your PhD advisees while they are creating?
I probably lay less a heavy hand than most of my colleagues do. I tell them we'll try to do this and then ask them how are they getting along and make suggestions and things. But I think the penalty of working for me is that they have to be kind of creative on their own. I expect them to ultimately do something.